Welcome to This Week in Digital Trust, 11M's regular conversation about all things tech policy, privacy, AI, and cybersecurity. I'm Arj, joining you today from Awabakal country.
And I'm Jordan, joining you from Wurundjeri country. And Arj, Apple or Android?
Apple all the way.
Apple all the way. You've vertically integrated your life. Do you have a watch?
I do have a watch. I have an Apple Watch. Well, look, like from my very first smartphone, pretty much Apple all the way, although I have strayed. I have strayed maybe about 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, like I don't think this is going to be that atypical, but like my iPhone screen cracked. You know, I probably sneezed too hard or something and it shattered. And it was back when, you know, it wasn't that easy to get screen replacements and I couldn't stomach stumping up another $1,000 or whatever it is to get another iPhone. Yeah, so I thought, oh, let's give this Android a crack, and then a crack, pun intended. And then, the user experience kind of wasn't what I wanted it to be, and I was drawn back to the fold.
Well, I've been committed to the Apple ecosystem, yes, from day one, and I cannot imagine the effort that would be involved in switching. It's mainly that, right? Like, I'd be kind of curious for a different phone, but like the number of apps I own, the number, like all my data's there.
Yeah.
I don't have an Apple Watch. I've got a Garmin watch though. So that's, you know, that's my way of like fighting the power.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is really
fighting. As we'll talk about later, it doesn't work properly with an Apple phone, but never mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, I found it hard 10 years ago and, you know, since got an Apple Watch and I rely on them a lot and I can't imagine not being in the ecosystem.
Yeah, so Apple versus Android is, well, it's really Apple versus the US federal government that we're talking about today. People might have read that the US Department of Justice, which kind of governs competition law, the equivalent in Australia is the ACCC, has sued Apple in the US, claiming that they have an illegally maintained monopoly in the smartphone market. So essentially, the DOJ is claiming that Apple is making products worse in order to maintain market dominance. So all of those lock-in things, like your data's stuck with them, your iPhone doesn't work with a non-Apple watch, stuff like that, the US Department of Justice is saying, no, that is unreasonably and unfairly maintaining your dominance and promoting your other products in a way that's harmful to consumers. So the Attorney General in the US, Merrick Garland, said Apple has maintained its power not because of its superiority, but because of its unlawful exclusionary behavior.
So the claim, the DOJ claim, sets out five areas. And it's actually, I encourage people to read it because it's actually, I'd never read a DOJ filing before, but it's actually pretty well written. Like it's very easy to read and there's a bit of sass in there and there's anecdotes. Like it starts with an anecdote. It starts with
a story. It's awesome.
This about this Apple exec emailing Steve Jobs at the time and saying, I've just seen an ad for a Kindle app reader and they're looking at it on the iPhone, and then they switch over and they're looking at the same app on the Android, and the story that people are going to get is that it's easy to switch from iPhone to Android, and you know, this is
a problem for our business.
This is a problem, and it's 2010, and so it's interesting to think about switching being, you know, such a fear for for Apple way back then. But anyway,
it is such an interesting submission, though, that like it does not read as a legal document, right? The FTC is clearly drafting for, like, there's enough legality stuff in there for the judge, but they are clearly drafting for a public audience.
So, as I was saying, it sets out basically five areas where the DOJ claims that Apple is kind of engaging in some sort of anti-competitive behavior. And those are, one, impairing the quality of cross-platform messaging apps. So, you know, classic, we'll talk about this, but the classic kind of green bubble, when you're messaging away from Apple into Android, and, you know, what that means for both the user experience and privacy and security. The second area is blocking super apps. So, you know, people would have heard of things like WeChat, which are these kind of big, broad apps that do lots of different things. And Apple has sort of limited the ability to access those, which makes it harder then to switch from the Apple ecosystem. Suppressing mobile cloud streaming services. This is commonly used for gaming and things like that. Can't get to these basically via Apple, which means you need the rely on the Apple ecosystem. Fourth area is diminishing the functionality of non-Apple smartwatches, which is already talked about. Like, Garmin. I am terrified of leaving Apple because I don't want this like mini brick on my wrist, basically, that because this Apple Watch can only work with Apple devices. And then the fifth area is limiting third-party digital wallets. So, you know, we all use Apple Pay increasingly, which is really super cool and convenient, but no one else can deploy a digital wallet on the Apple ecosystem and access that kind of, you know, secure NFC chip that makes that all work. Yep,
that's one that's particularly close to my heart in Victoria, because I still can't use my phone to tap on to a train or tram or public transport down here. If you've got an Android, you can. They've got a program, an app on Android that will emulate a MyKey card, but you can't do that on an iPhone, or they haven't put the effort in and gotten the approval from Apple and navigated their restrictive policies and stuff in order to do that. And so, you know, when I saw digital wallets on the complaint, I was like, yes, it's probably the most obscure one of the lot, but yeah.
Lots of attention in this one from, particularly from, I guess, you know, nerds who've complained about many of these things as that you're a nerd, but as you were just doing. But sometimes when I read about these things, like these kind of, you know, antitrust situations, I always wonder, like, what's the big deal? Like, if Apple want to design their ecosystem in a particular way, their phone in a particular way that restricts kind of certain kinds of apps, why is that a problem? Like, it's their platform, it's their ecosystem. And so sometimes that question comes to mind. And I remember you explained this really well some time ago. I think we were talking about Amazon and Amazon's ability to kind of do similar things with its platform and what retailers it allows on. But you explained this idea of, you know, anti-competitiveness and why it's wrong for such dominance in a particular category through a baker analogy. Like, do you remember that?
I love that that stuck with you, because it was just a seat of the pants analogy. But like, I'm very much not a competition lawyer, right? So I don't know the details, but like in general, I mean, principle of capitalism and markets is competition is good, right? If you have one player that owns or dominates in a particular market, that is bad. You don't, you know, consumers and society is served by having that pressure of competitors keeping prices down and stuff. So that's the source of the law. And particularly in Australia, so the Americans are very focused on consumer harm, right? If there's a monopoly, then prices will rise and consumers will be harmed. Competition law, as I understand it in Australia and I think in Europe as well, is a lot more focused on the efficient functioning of markets. So the baker analogy was like, you know, there are lots of bakeries. Because there's competition, the best bakers win. You know, they can charge higher prices if they're really good, whatever. The market determines all of that. What you don't want, if you want a well-functioning bakery market, is influences from outside. So if I produce all the flour in Victoria, if I have a monopoly on flour, I can be a kingmaker in the bakery market, right? I could choose which bakers I'm selling flour to for low prices, or I can choose who gets my highest quality flour and withhold it from everyone else. And so that interferes with the bakery market, right? So there's this kind of principle that dominance in one area should not be able to be pivoted into dominance in some other area. I shouldn't be allowed to decide which bakeries succeed by dominating the flour market.
Yeah, or if you're actually playing across the different layers of the vertical, if you opened a bakery, you could self-preference because you dominate the flour market, and if you were to charge higher prices or sell crappier flour to all your competitors, you would then suddenly own the bakery side of the, you know, equation.
And
as
that vertical integration is what goes on in tech markets, right? So in the Amazon case, they're running the store, the online marketplace, and they're competing, selling products within that marketplace, and they're preferencing themselves. In the Apple case, you know, they're doing a similar kind of, look, a lot of Apple's whole business model is that they're vertically integrated, right? And that's part of the value proposition, actually, that they tightly integrate the like hardware of the phone with the operating system, with, you know, the elements of other hardware, the watches, the apps and so on. And, you know, the kind of their response to a lot of the allegations of in this lawsuit is, well, that's by design, that's for security, that's for privacy, that's for efficient functioning of our services. leave us alone. We're not artificially influencing the market. We're just building good products.
You know, frankly, that's not just marketing spin. Like, that is often the experience of people. Yeah. Like I said at the start, like I kind of, you know, went and tried out the Android, and it was just too much to figure out. It was too disconnected, and I've always liked the seamlessness. And so, yes, like there is a part of that that's genuine and true. What's interesting, I think, for us in this conversation is what you sort of alluded to, which is the use of security and privacy as part of that narrative. Mm. And so Apple have always said, not only do we pull this stuff together really well in a really well-designed way and it works seamlessly, but we do this, we have this kind of integration and we have these rules that maybe, you know, the DOJ sees as being restrictive on competitors at the different layers. But what we're doing is we're managing the privacy needs and expectations of customers. And, you know, people will be familiar with the overt branding that Apple does around like privacy and security. So, you know, the app store's only got good quality, secure apps on it, as an example. What's interesting here, which we're going to talk about, is that the DOJ claim very explicitly goes after that presentation from Apple and says this is just a bogus fig leaf that you're using for anti-competitive reasons. It's actually not around privacy and security. So that's, I think that's one area that's interesting.
Yeah, it's so interesting, right? And it, like the DOJ claim really sets that out quite well in a lot of their specific complaints. So, and when you interrogate it, I think it makes total sense, right? So like, for example, those messaging apps, like it is the year 2024 and I can't send easily in a message a video from an Android phone to an iPhone or vice versa. Like fine, iPhone to iPhone, but you know, richest company in the world, technological wizardry, legions of software developers, they can't figure that out. That's a little bit suspicious, right? That it works perfectly between iPhones, but somehow it's impossible to agree on a standard that would allow a messaging of a video.
It's interesting to see how much that phenomenon has also become a cultural phenomenon. So this idea of the green bubble. So, you know, when you message someone from an iPhone to an Android, instead of the trademark kind of blue speech bubbles, you get a green bubble. So that's always stood out. But then, you know, I was reading an NPR report about this idea of green bubble shaming that happens.
I'm curious, actually. It might just be a young people thing. Yeah.
It's a American thing, but I think it's definitely a young people thing, at least in the reports I read, and reports of people being made fun of because of the green bubble or being found to be less attractive because of their green bubbles. This was in an NPR survey or report.
Oh, my goodness.
And so there's this idea of green bubble shaming or green bubble stigma. So that's how embedded it's become in the culture. But, yeah, you know, there's obviously a more serious side to that, which is around, like, the user experience and the functionality is less than, but also questions around privacy and security.
Yeah. And the super interesting thing about that DOJ complaint is that they attack that like really directly. So there's this great quote in that complaint that goes, Apple wraps itself in a cloak of privacy, security, and consumer preferences to justify its anti-competitive conduct. It spends billions on marketing and branding to promote the self-serving premise that only Apple can safeguard consumers' privacy and security interests. In the end, Apple deploys privacy and security justifications as an elastic shield that can stretch or contract to serve Apple's financial and business interests. So they'll say things like, oh, we couldn't possibly let other watches connect to our phones in the same way because we can't guarantee your safety, or we can't let these super apps in, or the game streaming because they can update it in the background and we wouldn't review that, or, you know, we need our app store review processes that happen to take weeks for every update. We must have those in order to protect you, which, like, you know, the best lies are mostly true, right? And there is truth to those arguments. The App Store is super good and safe because of those controls. It's a secure ecosystem because of those controls. But they are also weaponizing those controls, is the DOJ claim, in order to, you know, attack competition. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some interesting things there. Like, as you said, and there's some great Verge coverage on this particular lawsuit, which kind of has quotes from, you know, various think tanks where they've said, look, genuinely speaking, Apple's App Store, for example, is safer than, you know, many of the Android apps found on Android phones because they have locked it down. So there is some truth to it. But the other nuance is that, you know, with something like messaging, Apple will claim, well, you know, iMessage is end-to-end encrypted, so we're looking after everyone's privacy and security. But by not allowing these cross-platform apps, when someone, what that green bubble means is that a message from an Apple user to an Android user is not, is going on to the carrier service through the sort of like the telco carrier service, which is not encrypted. So, you know, they're creating a less secure experience for the ecosystem, if you like. Even if, you know, Apple to Apple users continue to get the blue eye message and they say that's encrypted, by forcing, you know, the green bubble to happen, what that means is the broader ecosystem, when they're messaging outside the Apple ecosystem, end up in this unencrypted, less secure experience.
Yeah, and that's the consumer harm thing, right? Like that's the thing that the DOJ is attacking as well, is that, you know, they claim their decision making is all for privacy and security, but there are these examples, like if you're messaging between Apple and Android, or if you're, you know, and not being able to use, say, WhatsApp or Signal or something as the default rather than carrier servers, by not letting their users have that, they are making a worse product for they're harming their consumers, right? They're willing to, in order to prevent the growth of those apps, in order to prevent easy switching and protect the lock-in that, you know, iMessage provides, they're providing a worse service in protection of the monopoly. So
it's also just interesting as a, I guess, a tactical move by the DOJ to be so overt, because you know, it's obviously preempting what Apple's defense would be, which has worked previously. There have been previous lawsuits, Epic versus Apple, where similar claims were made. This, in this case, was more so around the App Store and the restrictiveness of the App Store, and Apple defended that on the grounds of privacy and security. So I think the DOJ are kind of aware of what Apple are going to come out with and sort of preempting that and saying, look, we know you're going to come out and say privacy and security, but actually you're making a less secure experience in many contexts. Like, the reason I'm particularly interested in this kind of narrative around privacy and security is because I think, you know, within our professional community, we've often sort of like heralded Apple's very vocal, overt focus on privacy and security. Like, you know, we've drunk the Kool-Aid to a certain extent, sure, because it's not common to hear big tech companies being so overt. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're talking billboards, right? Like, Apple puts out ads, TV ads and billboards that say, you know, privacy, 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 which is rare. Mm. But I've always been a little bit more cynical about that ever since I read about this idea of a strategy credit, which is a term that Ben Thompson, who writes a newsletter called Stratechery, coined, which is basically the fact that they are able to make this sort of sell around privacy, not because they're particularly, you know, high-minded and kind of ethically minded around privacy. It just happens to suit their business model. Like, they're not in the game necessarily of doing lots of things with data in the way that Google is, because it wants to sell advertising. They want to sell expensive phones. And so if they can create a user experience that keeps you coming back every 2 years to buy, you know, an expensive phone, that's what they're about. They don't need to do a lot with your data. So they get a credit, a strategy credit around privacy, rather than, you know, it being because they're well intended. This takes that even further. The DOJ is sort of saying, not only like is it an unearned credit, actually it's being cynically deployed to mask this much more ugly sort of anti-competitive stuff.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting, right? I'd quibble with you a little bit in that, like, they do good stuff, good ecosystem, you know, like, they do well, like you were just saying, the App Store is safer, like, in general, they do pretty well. So, like, it's not all this cynical kind of play, but that's kind of the point of that strategy credit, right, is that you can commit to this thing because you're not sacrificing a huge amount. But the DOJ complaint is that, you know, is not saying that they don't do any security. It's saying that they use that as a cover for other bad behaviors, and that ultimately, when push comes to shove, they will choose the economic interest rather than the security one.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a fair call that you make, because I think, you know, to some extent it comes down to, like, do you take Apple's word for it or not? And, you know, like you say, there's an argument, like I pointed to the Verge article, and there are outcomes that, you know, independent people point to where they say there are good security and privacy there outcomes on the App Store in these areas. And so is it the right balance to say, well, actually we want to prioritize antitrust public policy outcomes over, like, if users are happy with the privacy and security that Apple delivers however they get there, is that okay? Yeah. Like, let them choose that. And if that's what they want, let them, you know, if that's also been an argument we've often made, which is like, let people choose privacy and see what happens. And
it's a really interesting question, right? Because it's particularly interesting because you see it in other areas. Like, I think we've talked about cookies and Google's plans to, improve privacy on the internet, get rid of third-party cookies from Chrome. I won't get into it, but other browsers already have ditched third-party cookies. Google still holds onto them. But the solution to online tracking that Google is proposing is kind of just that Google holds all the data and that they give good little bits of privacy protective information out to people. Objectively, probably that is a better privacy result. Like, that's a good result. Like, if you just, monopolies are often quite good for privacy because you're only sharing your information with one party and they've, you know, it's in their interests to hold it. So, you know, but like, there's kind of other considerations there that, you know, like that in that context, competition law is really pulling against kind of privacy and security. Like, big, vibrant, competitive markets aren't always the most secure markets.
And I think you get a sense of why the DOJ are really looking to act against this kind of monopoly behavior. If you read the filing, where they talk about the future prospects, they're sort of very conscious of Apple's kind of future expanding influence with the expansion into kind of automotive and content creation and entertainment sectors. And so if that monopoly power kind of extends, not just in the sort of phone context and the watch context, but into all of these other industries and domains, then we have a problem. And, you know, there was a great little tidbit or sign of this just the other day. Lina Khan, the FTC commissioner, was on the Jon Stewart show and talking about antitrust. And Jon Stewart said that he used to run a show on Apple, The Problem with Jon Stewart. And he said to her that Apple told him he couldn't interview her on this show. And so, you know, he kind of has a bit of a bombshell, but that's a sign of kind of the excesses of power reaching well beyond sort of smartphones and how they work into the content that is produced, the entertainment content that is produced for us. If you take that story at face value, which I guess I do.
That's so interesting though. I love that Lina Khan was on The Daily Show as well. Like, you know, regulators on mainstream, you know, popular culture, like, we need more of that.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So the other thing that I find super interesting about this whole story and this whole battle is it really is at its core an argument about how technology should work, how interoperable systems are. As you said before, like, should Apple be allowed to decide what goes on a phone or not? Phones are a bit of a special case, but like, historically, computers, like, in the early 2000s, Microsoft did try a fair bit to control what goes on a PC, a Windows computer. And in fact, there was a big antitrust case in the US against Microsoft about the power that they were trying to exert. They were trying to crush a competing web browser called Netscape in favor of Internet Explorer to try to dominate the kind of internet browser market. The point is that the US Department of Justice takes a lot of credit for the then explosion of software, internet, diverse businesses online and so on, because they prevented Microsoft from controlling that. And I think this case against Apple, the DOJ is thinking in very much the same way. It's the same thing, but on a phone. That, like, Apple's been allowed to maintain these really restrictive ecosystems. And, you know, there's some justification for that in terms of privacy and security, but ultimately, if Apple can control everything that happens on their devices, and like most of us have one, conduct our life through that device, then like that's a problem for, you know, all sorts of reasons.
I found it quite curious to see there was quite a bit of favorable reaction from the tech industry and from Silicon Valley around this DOJ filing. And I was like, you don't normally see, you know, that, that like that kind of support for any for legal regulatory kind of action against big tech. But putting it in a context that you've just put it in, which is that that kind of action actually has so many upstream and downstream effects on the ecosystem, and then, you know, from all the other parts of, you know, the technology ecosystem being able to flourish, you can see why, like, you know, kind of removing those kind of that chokehold is important for the broader tech industry as well.
The other thing I want to do there is compare it to what I would term the European approach, which is like just regulate, pass a law that says these systems have to be interoperable.
Yeah.
You know, the US approach is you have a rock star kind of FTC commissioner, you have a Department of Justice that's going after these guys in the courts, and that's going to take about 5 years, and who knows if they'll be successful. It'll depend on all these like really specific legal technical arguments about what's the market we're talking about and how dominant is Apple and whatever. Go over to the EU and they're like, well, we'll just pass the Digital Markets Act and make a rule that your messaging systems must be interoperable. Job done. I mean, you know, that'll also take like 5 years. But the comparison I'd like to make is that like the EU is very, like, I feel like a lot more predictable and a lot more stable for business, that like this stuff has been, the Digital Markets Act, those requirements have been coming for ages. You know they're coming. You know who they're going to apply to, how to build for it. The US approach, partly because, you know, the state of their political system, they're having trouble regulating anything, but like doing this via the courts is super unpredictable and not a good way to go.
Yeah, that comparison is super interesting. But yeah, look, I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. To your point, like the political headwinds change quickly as well. So whether the DOJ can kind of outlast that, we'll see. But
yeah, and it will be years, not, you know, months, right? So appeals and whatnot. But
I think that means, Jordan, you're going to have to, you know, suffer not being able to send videos to your Android
friends.
Yes,
they're not going to immediately solve my video and watch troubles and my Mikey troubles. I'll look to the Victorian government for that. So yeah, not a quick solution, but still satisfying. And I'm really looking forward to watching if it progresses. One of the things I love about these is like all the emails, like you mentioned a few of them, but like all of the, like, never send emails, like, ever. they'll end up in court. It'll be a nightmare. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to all these like tech executive emails kind of dribbling out as part of the proceedings. They're always good fun. So
good one. Okay.
Look forward to that.
That was fun. Thanks, Jordan.
Right. Thanks, Ash. Talk next week.